You are listening to KLRN Radio, where liberty and reason still reign.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's largest mortgage lender. Spring will be here soon, so if buying a new home is on your to-do list, right now is the time to call Quicken Loans. Learn about which mortgage options make sense for you and get a jump on your competition. With our exclusive Rate Shield approval, the low rate you lock today is protected for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. With a Rate Shield approval, if rates go up, your low rate stays locked. But if rates go down, you get that new, even lower rate. Either way, you win. Talk to us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com to take advantage. Here's another great reason to work with us. For a record 9 years in a row, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination. Again, to lock in today's low mortgage interest rate and get the security of our exclusive Rate Shield approval, call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
For J.D. Power award information, visit jdpower.com. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Hi, welcome to this Subway ad for the new Sesame Ginger Glazed Chicken Signature Wrap. How would you like it?
I'll take a...
Sports announcer at home?
Yeah, how'd you...
We just know.
My wife picks up the new signature wrap. It's got double the rotisserie-style chicken mixed with a sesame ginger glaze. She appears annoyed at me, but she shrugs it off. Those sweet and savory flavors are calling her name. She lifts the wrap and... She takes the bite! Incredible! And now she's closing the door on my... Subway, make it what you want.
Limited time only at participating restaurants. Double meat basement, average 6-inch sub.
I'm Little Teapot, short and stout.
Here is my handle and here is my spout.
No, Dad, like this. When I get all steamed up, then I shout, tip me over and
tip pour me out.
This is WWE superstar Roman Reigns. It only takes a moment to make a moment. Take time to be a dad today.
Visit fatherhood.gov, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Gotta love it, gotta love it. And good evening and welcome to the red carpet. This is the premiere episode, first ever for the brand new KLRN podcast here called Disasters in the Making, where a couple of entertainment journalists, I guess you can call us, get together so we can crack wise on Hollywood and get smart about dumb movies if we can. Myself, I'm Brad Slager. I'm a writer at a number of outlets and cover the business side of Hollywood. A lot of the times I cover the promotions and marketing, as well as some of the politics involved with the studios. And joining me for our first ever episode here would be my partner in crime on it, Paul Young. Paul, how is it going this evening?
Brad, my friend, it is going good. How are you?
I'm excited. It's premiere night. It's the sneak preview here of our show, as they say. Thursday nights is when they sneak all the brand new releases. So I think we're right in perfect timing here.
Well, I got my sneak yesterday, actually, for the new Spider-Man movie.
I don't think
we're going to be covering that one on our list, though. That was not a disaster. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, I think that one's going to be a rather quality effort. That's probably going to be on the other side of the spectrum than what we are covering. And just to kind of ease into the program, give people an idea of what we're talking about, we're going to probably use a cinematic method here and go with do a little bit of backstory, kind of explain everything, what we have in mind here, show. Basically, what we got in planned store for the show is Paul and myself are both somewhat experts, if you want to call it that, in bad movies. It's just a passion that the two of us share, and we spend a lot of times on social media bouncing titles back and forth off each other. You got to see this. Have you caught this one yet? And in the process, too, of being passionate about this kind of cinematic crap, if you want to call it that, I've also got an interest in other aspects of Hollywood that are like similar quality, bad marketing, some of the curious decisions they make in the studios, and just some of the fun cultural decisions they make. I think, Paul, safe to say you've got a similar taste for the entertainment industry. Do you not?
Oh, yeah. Give me the bad better than the good. I mean, the good, everybody knows what to expect when they go see a good movie, right? You're going to be entertained. You don't have to force that entertainment upon yourself. You don't have to look for the little gems and the nuggets that make things entertaining, because it's all right there being spoon-fed to you. But you watch a movie with a really bad budget, a really low budget, something that they had to scrape things together and people had to, you know, pay for craft out of their own pocketbook. That's where you start finding the good stuff. That's where the entertainment comes from, because your expectations are low. Kind of like how I got married.
Okay, low expectations. So she's not listening tonight is what you're saying. That's good news. All right.
She already knows. she already knows. You keep those expectations low 21 years later, you know, they're still together.
Hunter, got it. That's a classic case of under-promising and over-delivering.
That is correct, sir.
Well, one of the intentions I think we have for this show is to kind of spread our enjoyment of this level of entertainment for others so that there's an appreciation across the board. I mean, sure, we're going to tear apart Hollywood to a degree, but the intention is to help other people enjoy it at the same level, too. Even though the movies could be bad, horrible, there's an enjoyment to it. There's something to watching these kind of films and what Hollywood puts out there. So hopefully we can convey that to listeners.
And we should be clear, we're not making fun of any of the efforts or the talent behind these movies, right? We're not trashing them. We're not pulling them down. This is not about making them feel like they are bad movies. But they clearly know that there are some heavy missteps behind a lot of these films and the making of them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, like I said, there's enjoyment to be had. And there's also going to be multiple levels of these, because when it comes to bad films, I mean, you could have your $500 budget effort with no talent involved. You can have high-priced, massive budget productions that just failed miserably. There's everything from bombs to just misfires to mistakes all in general. And I think part of our attention, too, is going to be not just highlighting what was in the movie that's bad itself, but use our professionalism to also kind of explore what went on in the production side of things that led to it. That's where Disasters in the Making, I think, will really kind of differentiate ourselves from the other bad movie outlets that are out there. We'll kind of explain why, not just the how. So briefly, what I thought might be a good idea, since anybody listening is probably going to say, why should I listen to these guys, is kind of throw out our resumes there a little bit and give people a little bit of a primer who we are. So Paul, give us, if you can, briefly, your professional history in movies.
Well, back in 2009, I started reading a news website that's pretty popular around here now called ScreenRant.com. Back in the day, they were just a fledgling little site, had about six or seven writers doing some stuff. I went and saw what I thought was a pretty bad film. I noticed that it, Observe and Report. I don't know if you're familiar with that Seth Rogen vehicle.
Oh yeah.
That it deserves to be. We could actually probably talk about that film on this broadcast at some point. And I noticed nobody had written a review for it, so I went ahead and submitted my own review, because that's what you did back 10 years ago. And the owner of the website contacted me and said, "Would you like to write for the site?" And I've been with them ever since.
Oh wow! So you've primarily been entrenched at the one outlet.
That I have not been with anybody else.
Oh, wow. Nice. That's quite the opposite of myself. I kind of cut my teeth long ago with Chris Gore's website, Film Threat, which was really centered mostly on independent film, film festival kind of thing you would see, or not see, because they were only in festivals. But Chris Gore was kind of a superhero when it came to film festivals. He was a god back in the day. So we got to see just about anything and everything. He would get so many submissions that he would just, you know, dole out VHS and DVDs to us, you know, guys, review something out of this pile. And I would even get a box delivered to me every few weeks with a couple dozen titles, and I'd have to review one or two. But through that, I managed to go to Sundance Film Festival one year with the site. I got a job with the Fort Lauderdale Film Fest and got to help operate the Art House Theater year-round. So my exposure was to everything. I saw foreign films, documentaries, shorts, you name it. So pretty much the whole scope of cinema was available to me, sometimes against my will. But
I think the most interesting thing I've ever done as far as reviewing movies is I got invited back in 2010 to be a judge for one of those 48-hour film festivals. Have you ever been a part of any of that stuff?
Nothing of that sort. I've heard of them, though.
Woo, man. There's some people that can really make some movies under crunch times. There are some people that cannot. You know, so I watched some stinkers, man. And I know they're under the gun to get it done, but whew.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like the content I would get. At Film Threat, for instance, he sent me a picture one time of his hallway closet. It was stacked floor to ceiling with just the postage boxes loaded with discs and you name it. I mean, floor to ceiling.
That makes me jealous.
And he said, wow, this is what I got to choose from. So he would just basically go in there, two fists, throw them in a box and mail it to my house. The dog would avoid the box sometimes. That's how bad these things were.
Just had a reek on it, huh?
Yeah, and I even said, man, that's a year's worth of movies right there. And he laughed at me. He says, I can empty that closet out today. Inside of a week, it'll be filled up one more time. That's how many people were submitting to him, desperate to get reviewed. So, yeah.
They probably don't do that anymore. I get a lot of requests for screener links now. I don't think they're sending out quite as many discs. No. That probably slashes the budget in half or doubles it.
Yeah, I got the same. I have a number of PR firms that I'm in touch with, and every so often they're like, hey, are you interested? Or if there's something coming out that's caught my eye and I reach out to them, yeah, I'll get a Vimeo link or, I'll get an email address you submit, and then you can, digitally have access to them. But yeah, that was back in the day. That was how it was done. And I saw some things that would cross your eyes. They were so bad. And
Well, I don't understand. We've known each other for 3 or 4 years now, and you've never sent me any of these movies. Should I be questioning our friendship?
No, actually, you should see how strengthened it is that I haven't shared these movies. I don't even I don't think I even have the physical copies I used to have. There were a couple I did hang on to, and I lost them in a hurricane. But
you just air quoted the word lost, didn't you?
Oh no, it was. Every so often I would get that one, you would watch it and just, you can't believe this was put down in any kind of format and sold as a movie. Put it aside. I'm keeping that one. And there was one, it was an Italian horror movie, quote unquote. And this is a guy that had his IMDb resume was like extensive, nearly 100 films. And they bragged about how he used to work with the classics in the 60s. And I mean, supposedly he was, with the high class directors and such. And this film, he just had like random shots of a beach. It looked like at times the camera just had the power button left on and he forgot about it. It was supposed to be a horror movie of vampires. There was hardly any dialogue, mainly, women laying out in the sun and this other woman looking at her. This one that was supposed to be a vampire is walking around a resort area with a body stocking that was see-through. She was about 55 years old and looked like my aunt. She wasn't sexy in the least, and she's doing this in public on a beach. And I'm thinking, it's curious because most vampires aren't supposed to be in the sun, and here she is at a beach resort in the middle of high noon. But that's the kind of level of attention to detail he had in this.
I'm not going to lie. I just took the family to the water park this afternoon, and you just described most of the people there.
Yeah, exactly. So that was his quote vampire unquote. But yeah, that's kind of content we have been exposed to and have an affection for. I did have one question for you though, and I probably already know the answer since you've written at one outlet. But I'm not even positive. What is your political stance? You call yourself Republican, conservative, libertarian?
I'm a center, right, a center libertarian.
All right. I was just curious.
I'm an actual card-carrying libertarian. I changed my party affiliation a few years back.
Me too.
Official.
Sorry, had to throw that in there. But yeah, you're not alone.
Now, the only reason I was asking is I was curious if you ever encountered any resistance or pushback of a political nature since you're writing in the entertainment industry.
No, the former owner was a right-leaning Republican. The new owners, they're from Canada. They don't really mix their personal politics into the way the site's run, but they do allow for more social issues to be brought forth, which is fine. Everybody's got an opinion, and they give them the ability to share it. So if I want to share mine, they would allow me to do that too. So they don't really, you know, hold back on which way they're going to go with things. Though, you know, they do tend to keep everything related to movies and TV and right. that kind of stuff. So I have never personally experienced that with the site. But like I said, I've only been with the same site for 10 years. So
no, it's good luxury. And, you know, I mean, I haven't really, you know, experienced blackballing or anything of that nature. But a few years ago, I was writing, you know, one of the favorite sites I'd been at was Movie Line, which was at the time just a fantastic outlet. Smart people, funny.
Is that the one that got bought out by like AOL or?
I'm not even sure what the syndicate was. I mean, technically, I think it's still alive, but all it does is play trailers and promos. You know, that's it. There's no content any further. And when I was there, though, you know, it used to be a group of writers from the old Defamer website, which was really just scorching Hollywood, but hilarious. Group of those writers got together and reconstituted Movie Line. It used to be a hard copy new magazine back in the 90s, but they came up with a digital version of it. And just, you know, really smart, hilarious people I admired. And I managed to insinuate myself into the site there, but after, you know, you look at the email chains and discussions and such, you know that pretty much the entire staff was left of center. So I kind of had to check my political leanings a little bit. Personal choice, though. You know, it wasn't like I was oppressed. It was, you know, I wanted to write there. I chose to. But one of the things I found was at times that it actually afforded me an advantage. You know, certain stories might break about studios and such, you know, like Harvey Weinstein one time was lobbying the state of California to get tax breaks because so many movies were fleeing California for other areas like Canada and such. And, you know, I just pointed out to my editor, I said, that kind of runs contrary because this guy was a bundler for Obama and they were, you know, pushing for higher taxes and argued against jobs going overseas. And they were scorching Mitt Romney about that. And they were proper union backers. And here he is with, you know, demanding lower taxes and lower union fees. And my editor just like never even dawned on him. He's like, that is an amazing perspective. Never even thought of that. Yeah, we got to include that. So I would like on the sly kind of insinuate my political views that way. Not overtly, but really kind of pointing out the folly of
her. Yeah, sure.
But that's, you know, it's kind of what you choose to do. And then, you know, once that dissolved, I just basically found that the opportunities were limited, so I just really started aiming at conservative outlets because culture and entertainment is really underserved in a lot of the outlets. So I've kind of developed my own voice, if you will. I don't really do movie reviews so much as I do, you know, covering the business side and the political side.
Oh yeah, I read your stuff quite frequently. You think I don't click on those links you send me, but I do.
Well, it wasn't a test, but. By episode 5, I will expect at least 80% return. So,
okay.
That's real. I mean, that's what you're getting as far as your two guideposts here on the show. So, Paul and I kind of hammered it out in the past week. What are we going to do for our premiere episode? You know, we need a good opener here. And considering that next week is July 4, it almost made perfect sense, if not the ideal selection, to do a holiday-themed movie of that sort. And so we have chosen to focus in on Independence Day Resurgence, which is the...
It should be regurgitation.
Yeah, that would be very appropriate. And funny enough, that's one of the problems, I think, with this production. How unfocused they were. Did you see how many different...
Like 5 or 6?
How many versions of the colon title they went with? They were trying to come up with the, because that's the thing you do with sequels now, you have to have the title colon and an explainer, you know, like Breaking 2 colon Electric Boogaloo.
And if you're J.J. Abrams, you're going to have like a dash and then something else added to the end of it.
Yeah, well, they did that with John Wick this summer, too.
Yeah.
John Wick, colon, chapter 3, dash, parabellum. Like, can we, yeah. You can maybe ease off on the punctuation just a little, because he doesn't talk that much in these movies.
No, he does. Yeah, he keeps it to a minimum.
But, yeah, for this one, I mean, they were choosing, for some reason, all of the choices they had were starting with the letter R. It was either Independence Day Rises, or Returns, or Requiem, or Retaliation. For some reason, that was my favorite one.
Because, you know, that if you're going to title your movie Requiem, everybody's going to think, or at least I do, of Alien versus Predator Requiem, the second one, which was worse, obviously, way worse than the first one.
I think that's just a word. Yeah, you're really going too big on the vocabulary when you got explosions and aliens. I mean, Requiem? No, come on. This isn't a book report for college here. We're doing a popcorn movie in summer. So
exactly.
They ended up settling on Resurgence. Funny enough, they said they chose Resurgence because that's one that's not used often in titles. And then later that summer, there was Godzilla Resurgence. There was a TV show called Resurgence. And yeah, I think then the regurgitation started to take place.
You know, and Emmerich started writing this movie, back shortly after the first one came out? Was it like the early 2000s?
Initially, yeah. And then
it took them 14, 15 years to make this movie?
Well, not so much that, and just maybe help people along too. We're talking about Roland Emmerich here. He's the writer-director. Emmerich is known for disaster movies. Now, some of them also end up becoming disasters themselves unintentionally, and thankfully they do because they're so much fun when that happens. But Roland Emmerich's trademark in Hollywood is destroying the most famous landmarks he possibly can in every single film.
Well, you see what's coming up next, right? Did you see what dropped today? Speaking of Emmerich?
No, I did not.
Sir, he's going to destroy all of Midway. Hawaii is going to get toasted once again. And not and not by Michael Bay.
I was going to say, haven't these people suffered enough?
Well, Bay took out Pearl Harbor, obviously. You know, we all know how that turned out. It was a love story for whatever reason. Emmerich, looks as if he's approached this from the Go America team side of things. You know, Go Navy. I mean, it looks pretty good. I got to admit, I'm intrigued.
And that's the thing, you know, to help people along. If you're not familiar with Emmerich by name, you certainly know his films. He did the original Independence Day. He also did Day After Tomorrow. He did the disaster epic 2012. Was it White House Down? Was that the other one that had terrorist attack in the White House with?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Jamie Foxx is the president. So you probably have seen this guy's work, and his movies are visually staggering. He puts in some amazing visuals. Amazingly enough, though, he can have all these computers for graphic interfaces, and yet none of them seem to have a word processor because his scripts are garbage.
Yeah, standard autocorrect. Just run it through. What's that website you can use to run all your stuff? Wordly or whatever it is?
Grammarly.
Grammarly. Run them through there. See how that works out.
Yeah, his characters are about as deep as a puddle in the parking lot. The character arcs are less impressive than anything you'll see at McDonald's. It's just...
But I'm okay with that if I know that's what I'm getting when I go in, right? I'm walking into McDonald's. And I'm getting a sandwich. I know later that I'm going to enjoy an extended amount of time in the bathroom. I know this going in, so it doesn't shock me.
Right.
If I'm going in there expecting some sort of steak and I come out, I'm just going to be disappointed altogether. Sometimes you at least want the sandwich that you know is going to be bad to at least be made well. And there's just a lot of things he does where things feel as if they don't mesh, and there's just bad storylines and plot devices are just, you know, too convenient even for a Godzilla movie, you know, that kind of stuff. Now, I will say Stargate's my favorite movie he's ever made. I'm just gonna put that out there. I see no wrong in Kurt Russell and Stargate. I will never talk about that film in in a bad light ever.
No, it was that one's solid. That's a sci-fi touchstone pretty much. But this this time around for Resurgence, he had a $165 million budget.
That's like Wachowski's kind of budget.
Yeah, that is a perfect example too. Because I mean, really, it is a case where the money went on screen. I mean, the visual effects in this thing at times are, you know, impressive to staggering and such. There's just long passages in this film where you're just, you know, you're watching a spectacle, and yet you really don't know what's going on. You know, it's like there's all kinds of things taking place and nothing is happening at the same time.
And you've got people like good actors in this movie. There are good actors in this movie. And mm-hmm. they're so, I mean, Jeff Goldblum and Bill Pullum. I mean, he comes back, and Judd Hirsch, and they do nothing with them. It's as if they forgot how to use those characters in a way that made any kind of sense. What is Judd Hirsch doing driving a bus through the Salt Lakes with a bunch of children on it? None of it makes any sense.
Yeah, and I was going to definitely get to that part.
You're watching, like, what are you doing, Roland?
You're at times watching massive things taking place on screen, and you're like, okay, cool, but why?
Why?
There's not a lot of explanation to it. So
no, he uses a lot of convenience in telling his stories.
Well, yeah, his script isn't so much a storyline as it is touch points. You know, we got to get out to the Nevada salt flat somehow and have an alien battle. How do we get there? And he kind of fills in a gap there.
You know why? He loves the salt flats. Loves it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
one of his favorite places to shoot.
There's all kinds of room to blow stuff up. There's really nobody barking and moaning about their property. And I'm sure securing the rights out there is probably a no-brainer, you know?
Oh, easily.
So it makes sense from a technical standpoint.
It does make me, I'm curious. For each of these films, everybody seems to know where Area 51 is and how to easily just drive up onto the property.
Without getting shot.
Without getting shot, or without the military even know you're coming.
Yeah. You're like, oh, we didn't even put a kettle on for you folks. Wow, surprise.
I couldn't find it without Google Maps, and there's RVs by the dozens driving that direction.
Yeah. Or in this case, a school bus, of course.
A school bus.
So, and you had, Cela Ward is another one that was completely wasted in this film. I think her go-to was just look in amazement with her mouth open. That was just about all she had to do.
Well, and, you know, they took the social gender thing and, you know, they made her president, which is fine. I like her fine enough. Or I like her acting. I think she's a pretty good actress.
She's very, very well talented.
She just wasn't given anything to do.
Nah, Emmerich was aiming for being 2016. That's when the movie came out. And Hillary's imminent presidency. So I think he was looking for a tie in there. So, he kind of shoehorns a lot of stuff in while at the same time not giving us enough, if that makes any sense. So,
you cram in so much, you miss it all.
Exactly. So, I mean, here's an attempt to, well, I tell you what, why don't we take an early half break here, because we're almost at the bottom anyway. We'll start to really uncap this thing and get into some other Hollywood details in a bit. So if you want to stick around with us, we'll get into the real meat of this movie and a couple other details. We'll come right back.
Listening to KLRN Radio, where liberty and reason still reign.
Hi, I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's largest mortgage lender. Spring will be here soon, so if buying a new home is on your to-do list, right now is the time to call Quicken Loans. Learn about which mortgage options make sense for you and get a jump on your competition. With our exclusive Rate Shield approval, the low rate you lock today is protected for up to 90 days while you shop for your new home. With a Rate Shield approval, if rates go up, your low rate stays locked. But if rates go down, you get that new, even lower rate. Either way, you win. Talk to us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com to take advantage. Here's another great reason to work with us. For a record 9 years in a row, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination. Again, to lock in today's low mortgage interest rate and get the security of our exclusive Rate Shield approval, call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
For J.D. Power award information, visit jdpower.com. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030.
Hi, welcome to this Subway ad for the new Sesame Ginger Glazed Chicken Signature Wrap. How would you like it?
I'll take a...
Sports announcer at home?
Yeah, how'd you...
We just know.
My wife picks up the new Signature Wrap. It's got double the rotisserie-style chicken mixed with a sesame ginger glaze. She appears annoyed at me, but she shrugs it off. Those sweet and savory flavors are calling her name. She lifts the wrap and... She takes the bite! Incredible! And now she's closing the door on my... Subway, make it what you want.
Limited time only at participating restaurants. Double meat base and average 6-inch sub.
I'm Little Teapot, short and stout.
Here is my handle and here is my spout.
No, Dad, like this. When I get all steamed up, then I shout, tip me over and
tip pour me out.
This is WWE superstar Roman Reigns. It only takes a moment to make a moment. Take time to be a dad today.
Visit fatherhood.gov, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
KLRN Radio has advertising rates available. We have rates to fit almost any budget. Contact us at advertising@klrnradio.com.
Of disasters in the making, where a couple of movie experts get together to hammer out what is wrong with Hollywood and specific movies. Now, we are right in the middle of summer blockbuster season, and tons of movies are coming out almost on a weekly basis, some major ones. And, of course, you know, the promotion machines are grinding, and they're doing everything they can to sell their pictures. They don't always hit the mark, however. Did you see this week, Paul, that Samuel L. Jackson was a little upset on the promotional tour for the new Spider-Man?
You talking about old Left Eye?
Well, yes,
Nick,
I guess I
Nick
am.
Left Eye, Nick Left Eye Fury.
I had to think about it for a second. Yeah, it is Left Eye because while he's, I think he's on the world tour right now. The movie is coming out here in the States on Tuesday, I believe it is.
Yeah, the 2nd. Yep.
And, you know, he's doing the worldwide tour. Sony's going to be doing the rollout worldwide. That's the way they do it, usually in summertime. But he came upon a problem during one of his stops. It turns out they had the banner sheets for the film at one of the locations, and he, being a character in the film, was featured on this one banner poster. Actually, two posters. They were side by side to each other. And what they had done in the graphics department was basically have him on one poster on the left side leaning to the right, and on the other poster on the right side leaning to the left. They didn't use independent images, however. They went into Photoshop and simply did a horizontal flip.
Mm-hmm.
And in so doing, his character Nick Fury, famous for having the eye patch, also saw his eye patch get transposed to the other eye.
Yep, even the scars.
Yeah, it was a clear... All they did was a 180 bounce on the image, and
but it was a foreign. Was it a Spanish or Italian that it happened? It was. It wasn't an American banner. It was somebody else, right?
I almost want to say he was in Asia, but it could be in Spain as well. I'm not sure where he was when it took place. Because the what was funny enough is that kind of the news came out. I was like, oh, look what they did here. This was kind of a graphics mistake, and I saw that, and I said to myself, wow, when Jackson sees this, he's going to flip out. And he did. He got on social media and, as predicted, was about as angry as he was seen in Snakes on a Plane. Who's this MF-er? That, I mean, he went on a rant, all caps, hashtagging the F word. I mean, he kind of lost it.
Yeah, he was not happy. He was not happy. He had some questions. He was inquiring minds, you know.
Yeah, his questions were along the lines of what MF-er has to get fired over this. So, it's been a tough summer for a lot of studios, a lot of the releases, and then everybody's on edge. So I don't think getting Sam Jackson upset is a really good idea.
No.
But on the other side of things, when it comes to some brilliant poster work, last week they did the reboot of Child's Play, the killer children's doll horror movie franchise. They're trying to reboot it. They have Mark Hamill in the role this time as the demonic voice of the killer doll. But what was really unique is they tried to go with some counter programming with the release. They came out last weekend at the same time as Toy Story. So you're really looking at kind of a vacuum in the marketplace because everybody's going to go see the kids movie.
Of course.
And I got to give them credit. You know, United Artists, they used to be a bigger studio in the 70s and 80s. Not so much anymore, but they got pretty avant-garde, let's say, with their promotional campaign, realizing they were up against a monolith of Toy Story. They released a series of posters that were pretty hilarious in that it featured their character of Chucky kind of just walking out of frame, and you see actual Toy Story characters rendered in violent fashion from the doll.
And I thought they were brilliant.
There was one with what is clearly Woody laying in a heap in the background with a puddle of blood. The springy dog was being barbecued over a fire, and the dinosaur was scorched with a flamethrower. And yeah, they didn't hold back. They really went for it there.
And that's, I think there's something else. He did something to Annabelle too. Like, he didn't just go after the toys. He went after Annabelle the doll.
Oh, really? That one I hadn't seen. Yeah. That even makes more sense. That's hilarious, though.
Yeah, good for them. I mean, I'm glad that there it is. I just found it. Yeah, she's completely decapitated. You see his eye and the broken, shattered piece of glass and a knife shoved into the base of her neck where her head should be.
It's so they're going for subtlety, I see there. Okay.
It looks like it. Yeah, yeah. It was very, very, very subtle. You have to look for the nuance.
Wow. I got to give him credit.
If your movie's not going to be any good, your posters might as well be.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely got a cult audience to it, and I don't know that you could really disappoint those people too much. So, yeah, they probably figured, why not swing for the fences? I mean,
And there's no reason not to. It's not as if this is a beloved franchise. Child's Play is not a beloved franchise. You know, only a group of people have seen it in the 80s and followed it all the way through. The bride, the seed, the child, the child of the child, Chucky versus Jason, or yeah, I'm sure there's one of those out there at some point. I would have actually watched that one had that happened. But
yeah, I think the only one they haven't tapped yet is Chucky in space.
Jason's been to space. I don't know if Freddy's been to space or not. He should be.
Yeah, Sharknado did a space visit, and I think Leprechaun too. Did it not have a space theme? I want to say in one of them.
Oh, I think wasn't that Leprechaun? Wasn't he an alien the entire time anyway?
Could be. I mean, it's.
He might have been.
I don't recall it from the Shakespeare play that the series is based upon, but I'll have to recheck.
I will say it looks like the Chucky reboot is doing a little bit better than the some of the other horror reboots that have been out there. I mean, it's sitting at 60% audience score. That's the one I follow most of the time when I'm watching something like this.
The thing with the horror movies, though, if they keep the budget low enough, they're going to get a lot of the, on the back end, the residuals. You know, when this goes to TV and to cable, that's usually where they'll really start to hit profitability. So if they can get even close to break even in the theaters, then they're going to be in good shape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But here's a bit of a surprise. I don't know if you've noticed this. One of the bigger promotional campaigns of the summer. What would you expect would be the franchise that's doing cross promotions with Burger King, Baskin Robbins, Coca-Cola, things of this stature? What movie would you think would earn that kind of attention?
Endgame, obviously.
No. In fact, something that's not even going to go to theaters. Stranger Things Part 3.
Oh, that makes sense, I guess.
They are really ramping up the tie-in promotions. I mean, they're reissuing New Coke just for the program.
Oh, see, that's stupid. That's just, do they not learn from their past mistakes? Yeah, New Coke was disgusting. It was it was worse than Crystal Pepsi.
Well, it's I think that is even part of it, but Coca-Cola, I mean, they're going all in. You know, they have a couple of cans you can find even where the Stranger Things logo is on the can, but upside down because of the plot line. And because it's set in the 80s when New Coke did emerge, for a limited time at least, they're doing New Coke special edition. It's on a couple of bottles. If you're really desperate enough and into this kind of stupid stuff, you could have been online for about 8 hours waiting to get an order place so you could have a special edition mailed to your house.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Don't ask me how I know this, because I'd be embarrassed to say I do have a box of New Coke with the Stranger Things logo on it, but that's, you know.
I would expect nothing less, sir.
Yeah, I had to break down. I've got a weakness when it comes to this kind of marketing stuff, and that just cracked me up.
Well, you know, maybe with all this marketing, though, Netflix can lower the amount they're charging me to watch their dumb original stuff.
Well, you know, they're still clinging to some of the more lucrative. I just saw yesterday, I think it was, they had a desperate plea. Oh, my God. The Office is going to leave Netflix, they say, in banner headlines. But, you know, and I was looking at this headline and everybody's freaking out on social media about it. And I was like, didn't they? I know for a fact they just paid a bundle to retain it. Well, yeah, this is leaving Netflix at the end of 2020.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they're like, oh, my God, I got to hurry up and binge watch this before it leaves in over a year and a half from now. But
yeah, I'll be honest with you. I find more stuff on Hulu now to binge watch than I do on Netflix.
Yeah, same. I tend to be on there frequently. We also have an infant staying in our house, and she managed to learn. She's 1 year old, but discovered that she could operate the Fire Stick, and she ordered HBO, we found out.
So infant needs their Game of Thrones, you know what I'm saying? Well,
I'm just flipping around. I was like, when the hell, who ordered this? And everybody's questioning it. And then one morning I wake up, there she is walking around hitting the buttons, and she's about to reorder it again. I was like,
she's looking for the Mother of Dragons, sir.
So I did.
Or maybe she's trying to catch up on Deadwood before they start doing something, before Westworld comes back out.
So while I did have it for a month against my will, I did binge watch Silicon Valley once again. So
I have not seen an episode of that.
Very well done. Very funny show, and well written, well performed. It's they skewer Silicon Valley. It's the same guy that did King of the Hill and Office Space. You know, he's got that kind of sharp social wit and brings it to there. So I recommend it. But when you want to get into some bizarre marketing, when it came to Independence Day resurgence, they had a lot of curious things going on there. This the marketing for this, they made some curious questions, I would say here. There's a book series that they had as a result of the first film. Now, again, this was made in 96, the first one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So they had a tie-in novel, and the movie was big enough that they started a novel series. And it became a 3-book arc of stories, and it was supposed to be rooted in the same universe. Now, you know, we were talking earlier about how they got the script for this sequel to be up. Dean Devlin is a production partner of Roland Emmerich. He's been there almost his entire career, helps write and direct every single one of his movies. And Devlin was going to start on the sequel, and I'm still unclear as to why he stopped. I mean, he was paid and everything and then supposedly returned the money, they say, which I don't believe, because that's not how Hollywood operates. There's not that kind of good grace ever in the industry. But I think what happened was they got into a series of other films that they made. And eventually, I think 15, 20 years later, they realized, you know, we've had a number of films that just didn't perform. Let's go back to the well. So they finally did. And they decided to pretty much bypass altogether that 3-book series and come up, I think, 5 or 6 people to write this script. And then when they did, they released another book entirely based on Resurgence alone, almost at the exclusion of the other. And then they even took it further and they had a comic book series, I believe.
They did. Yep, they sure did.
So, yeah, that's the irony in all of this, is that as little attention as they really do pay to the script, that there's this outpouring of literature about this movie series for some reason. 5 books and 6 comics revolving around a plot that you really probably could occupy in about 5 pages.
Yeah, and it goes a little bit further than that with the strange marketing, because they wanted to plaster it on everything. So at one point, they put Jeff Goldblum and Angela Baby, the I believe she's a Korean pop star, Asian pop star.
Yeah. I want to say China, but I don't.
She might be China. Yeah, I had never heard of her for the movie, but they put them in a plane with Manchester United players as fighter pilots in like one of the commercials.
Of course they did.
Like, and none of that made sense. Well, and then they moved to Japan and they made an entire Gundam suit for him.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, that kind of, you know, that's kind of right there in keeping with the movie itself. They don't really need to make sense as long as they got those special effects going.
If I can find it, I'll send it to you. It's what they did is they took the Statue of Liberty out of the poster and replaced it with the Gundam suit. It's kind of interesting, but
sure.
It has nothing to do with the movie at all.
All right. Well,
I don't get it.
Yeah, and I don't think it really matters. We don't really have to, because this is all right. Well, I'm going to try to hold people's hand through this storyline. I don't think it's going to be successful. Not that it's so complicated and you're going to get lost. It's just that you're going to take 2 steps in the forest and not know what the hell is going on. So we are 20 years in the future from the first film, and Will Smith, for the curious in mind, is not in this movie. They actually had intended to shoot 2 consecutive films, the 2nd and 3rd Independence Day, together. And Will Smith wanted to be compensated to the tune of about $50 million to appear in both films. And that was a little too rich for their blood, which I find a little bit of amazing, considering they had $165 million to spend on this thing. But, you know, you see him featured quite frequently at the beginning. I think he's on a mural in one of the White House buildings, maybe it is. And he's on some former president's desk. He's in his kid's locker at the Air Force Base. So, yeah, he's prominently featured at the beginning of this. And Liam Hemsworth is basically, I think he's our hero in this. There's just so many people doing things, it's hard to determine who's the focal point of the film. But
I think it does resolve around him and Jesse Usher as Smith's son.
Yeah, and they seemingly have a relationship, I think, even though they're not really together all that often, and we're just supposed to assume they're bros.
I want to say Hemsworth is Harry Connick Jr.'s son, or nephew.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, and then that they went to flight school together. It's been a minute since I've seen the movie, but I think that's about right.
Okay, yeah. And like I said, they're very light on the explanation of these kind of things. So it's not important if we miss them either. So
yeah,
Liam Hemsworth basically is a space tugboat pilot.
That makes sense.
There's an Earth space defense system. Is it on the moon or next to the moon? In space. It's this massive structure that they've constructed with all the technology they've gleaned from the aliens. And he operates what is essentially a tugboat. So, of course, he's our space pilot hero throughout this thing. He can drive just about any aircraft, even alien spaceships that he's encountered for the first time.
Of course. Well, why wouldn't you?
You could really see him straining with the storyline, too, because they had to justify why it took 20 damn years for things to transpire. So there's a massive ship just sitting in the desert in Africa, you know, surrounded by military people, and it just suddenly turns on. Brett Spiner, who we thought died in the first one, is actually alive. He's in a coma for 7,300 days, which I found a little curious. Like, people don't say, hey, you've been in a coma for 20 years. No, you've been in coma for 7,300 days.
It gives it a little more weight.
I suppose. And, we see him pop up in bed automatically because of his alien connection. And then we are blessed with the scene. Thank you, Roland Emmerich, of Brett Spiner walking with a hospital gown. And we have a close up on his ass as he's scratching it.
You know, some of us enjoy cinematic gold. Some of us don't.
That's your $165 million well spent right there. So what basically is happening here is the alien species that we defeated 20 years ago had sent some kind of a distress signal out, and the mother ships are responding to it finally. And here's a hint to anybody listening. If you want to see writing shorthand taking place in a script that's sci-fi in nature, anytime wormholes are implied or used, you know that's where they ran into a wall. So that's how they justify things here. A wormhole suddenly appears and large ships start appearing in our atmosphere as a result. And this is the bigger monolithic ships that are coming to reclaim what's theirs, and they want to get to the Earth's core for some reason. I think.
Well, our core just must be, everybody wants to get to the core. Everybody does. Our core is fantastic. We have the best core in the universe. I don't. I can't do a sit-up, but our Earth, fantastic.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, things that sound like they make sense when they're spoken until you actually sit back and think about it and you're like, huh? So for instance, they have this massive ship sending what they call a plasma drill into the ocean to go after the core, and they have every single ship in the area clear out except for one greedy ship that wants to get gold off of a shipwreck. So they tell them, you have to stay there and monitor it. And somehow these, they're profiteers basically, but they can determine how long this space drill is going to take to get to the Earth's core somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, you're pretty... I mean, honestly, you're probably closer than the actual film.
Yeah, these guys were, trying to scuba dive on a wreck to get $100 million in gold, but they can somehow ascertain when a plasma drill is going to pierce the core of the Earth in 1 hour and 3 minutes, approximately. So we have a countdown timer, conveniently enough.
And it does show the 3 minutes. It's pretty accurate technology. You can get it at just about any boat and tackle shop.
Yeah, really. It's I guess the Merchant Marines are up to date on all their technology, so that's good to know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't want to say they've resorted to deus ex machina here, but that whole white orb that they possessed, ton of questions. Because,
well, you know why? You know why you have a ton of questions? Is because this was supposed to be a trilogy. And those questions were supposed to be answered in the third film.
Oh, is that it? Okay, so I'm getting ahead of things because...
Yeah, they were originally supposed to... this was going to be shot back-to-back Lord of the Rings style. Seriously. And then that's what they were going to do. But then after the second one, after the second one bombed so poorly, Emmerich was like, oh, yeah, we still plan on making the second movie. We just got to get some stuff together. And then like a year and a half later, he was at Cannes or something. And he goes, we're not making this movie. I don't know if this movie ever get made. I'm not worried about this movie. I don't think we'll ever see a three.
Okay. Well, because here's my problem. There's this, it's a large white orb. Now, there, another ship apparently had come through the wormhole. We shot it into oblivion, fell into a crater on the moon, and we recovered this massive box. Inside this box that they had to cut open with a plasma laser, this white orb emerges that basically has artificial intelligence inside of it and regards us as a lesser species. But it starts communicating and telling us that it is here to assist us in defeating the insurrection of the aliens. and it knows all about them because its own planet had been overtaken and defeated by these aliens. Now, here are some of my questions. If it was of higher intelligence and here to help us, why could it not escape the paddock box that it was located in, for one? Two, how can it claim to have superior knowledge on how to defeat these aliens when it just said their planet was overrun and defeated by said aliens?
Two words. Well, three words. I'm going to go with two. That's what I'm committed to, two words. No opposable thumbs.
I suppose.
It can't open a box if they don't have any thumbs.
Okay. And, you know, and we're also told that the invading aliens are fearful of this orb creature because it knows how to defeat them, even though it just said that it was defeated by them. So,
yeah, it got its butt kicked, but it came to help us not get our butt kicked by using the formula they used to get their butt kicked.
Yeah, these aliens basically smoked us to oblivion, and you're a bunch of lesser creatures, but I can show you how to win based on my experience of not winning.
Exactly. That's, you know what, that's essentially the Democratic platform right now.
So, and then we get into just all manner of third act computer belched imagery where nothing makes sense. They have a monster creature of a spaceship with one little port on the top in Star Wars style that they have to hit. And yeah, there's just a lot of light and noise and stuff going on and things happen and none of it makes sense and none of it really has to.
And you know what's so sad about that is that Weta Digital did that big climatic battle scene that they put that together, and they've done such good work in the past, and then they come out and just like phoned it in for this. And I don't know, I know there's a lot of things that go behind the scenes, you know, when it comes to visual effects and how long they have to work on things and when they get the plates and when they can work, but my goodness gracious, that was just depressing to see. Good way to digital, the same people that did Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you know, on a technical basis, yeah, it's good work. It's just that
do you know how the first one, I mean, the first one won an Oscar for its visual effects. Do you know how? When they blew up a city, they created, I forget what the scale is, but they created a scale model of that city. Then they turned that city or that with the White House or whatever it would be on its side and then placed the camera at the bottom. And then up top, they exploded it and had propane with a propane flame going down through the city straight down to the camera. So that when you laid the camera flat, you know, and you looked at the screen, it looked as if that whole city was just blowing up. And then they went in, of course, you know, it's 1996, so the technology is a little different. I would argue that the graphics and the visual effects in the 1996 film are heads and shoulders above what they did in 2016.
Oh, yeah. And I think you know, a lot of it, too, is they probably resorted to a fair amount of practical effects as well, which look better all the time. Here it was just, you know, you're basically looking at a cartoon. I also love, too,
CGI crutch is what they're using now.
Yeah, that's all it was. You know, and the solution to this time to defeat the aliens was when they arrive, Jeff Goldblum realizes, oh, they're acting like a hive and we have to go after the queen because alien creatures from the other side of the universe that got here through a wormhole operate just like bumblebees. Sure. Okay. I'll buy that. I guess so. And that's pretty much it. You know, the countdown timer happens. We have about 30 seconds before they hit the core. They got the queen. Spoiler alert. Everybody survives. Everybody's a hero. And we even get the presidential speech from the new president because we managed to wipe out two of our presidents in this film. So that's a bit of a chain of command lesson take place, too. So just before we wrap up the show, Paul, here's a question for you. How many times do you think in his career so far, Roland Emmerich has brought serious damage to the White House?
Oh, goodness. As a director or as a writer?
Well, then, yeah, I'll say in director, his films.
Four.
Pretty close. This one marks the fifth time he's destroyed the White House. We of course, saw it blow up in the original. He has not quite full damage here, but one of the spaceship's landing gear comes to the planet and just pushes a massive amount of the Earth right up against the White House there. He had it snowed in completely for the day after tomorrow. He had it attacked and beaten to hell by terrorists, of course, in White House down. And in 2012, he had a massive tidal wave drop a tanker right on top of it. So, yeah. Roland Emmerich has some political issues with America, I think.
He doesn't like, but he's making Midway.
We'll see. We'll see what he takes it on. So that'll wrap it up. I hope we got some eye-opening accounts here for everybody. I want to thank anybody and everybody for giving us a chance here in our first episode. Come back in about 2 weeks after the 4th of July, next Thursday after that. Paul and I will start to do another forensic examination on another tragic movie and go over some other new Hollywood news.